admiration and respect comes with a powerful commitment. A pledge to protect this house. On Saturday, August 31st, the Queens Gaels will host the McMaster Marauders for their home opener at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Kickoff is scheduled for 6 p.m. and CFRC's coverage will begin at 5:45.
Baseball's being selfish. We want the best players in the world, and if those players happen to be African-American, from Asia, gay, we want to make it possible for them to succeed. And we want the players that are playing around that person to know that MLB's philosophy is that we are all in this together.
Recipe for hashish fudge. This is the food of paradise. It might provide an entertaining refreshment for a ladies' bridge club or a chapter meeting of the DAR.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Top U.S. court lets Republican states block queer student rights. Baseball's Billy Beane lives on in diversity training. And Baking Up a Storm with Alice B. Toklas. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Marcos Najera.
And I'm Sarah Montague.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 17th, 2024. Federal protections for LGBTQ students are getting no help from the U.S. Supreme Court. In a narrow 5-4 decision, the High Court denied an emergency request from the Department of Justice to enforce its interpretation of Title IX, the ban on discrimination based on sex in federally funded education. The dissent from the court's three liberals and conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch argued that sexual orientation could be covered, but did not address the more contentious gender identity provisions. The Department of Education announced in April that it would interpret sex in federal law to include sexual orientation and gender identity. Several Republican-led U.S. states reject that interpretation. Their requests to temporarily enjoin enforcement of the new policy have been granted by lower courts. On August 16th, the justices rejected the Biden administration's bid to enforce the sexual orientation aspects of its queer-inclusive policy during the ongoing legal challenges. The majority found that the administration had not provided this court a sufficient basis to disturb the actions of lower courts. Dissenting Justice Sonia Sotomayor asserted that there was no reason to block enforcement of the entire policy. She points out that only the gender identity provisions have been questioned in the lower courts. Sotomayor wrote, "By blocking the government from enforcing scores of regulations that respondents never challenged and that bear no apparent relationship to respondents' alleged injuries, the lower courts went beyond their authority to remedy the discrete harms alleged here."
Pope Francis met with LGBTQ activists from Uganda and Ghana this week. It was the first time the head of the Roman Catholic Church and queer African activists had been face to face. The pontiff joined them in condemning anti-queer legislation in both nations, specifically Uganda's notorious Anti-Homosexuality Act. Claire Bayarugaba is with the queer advocacy group Chapter 4 Uganda. She tweeted a video on the X platform of her shaking hands and kissing the Pope on both cheeks. Bayarugaba said that Francis repeated his belief that discrimination is a sin and violence against LGBTIQ communities is unacceptable. Bayarugaba was introduced to the Pope by Juan Carlos Cruz, a gay Chilean member of the Pontiff's advisory panel on protecting children from pedophile priests. Cruz is himself a survivor of clergy sex abuse. The August 13th meeting with Pope Francis also included Rightify Ghana director Ebenezer Piga. Right now, Ghana's president Nana Akufo-Addo is waiting for the Supreme Court's constitutional green light before he signs the horrific Promotion of Proper Human Sexual Rights and Ghanaian Family Values Bill. Under its harsh provisions, even being an LGBTQ plus ally would be a crime. Activist Piga said he was grateful for the Pope's progressive stance, especially his opposition to violence and discrimination. Pope Francis encouraged us to keep fighting for your rights, and that's exactly what we will do.
Team LGBTQ won a total of 42 medals at the Olympic Games in Paris. If all the out LGBTQ competitors were a team, it would have finished in 7th place for the most medals, according to the digital outlet Outsports. That, by the way, is a higher ranking than any country that still makes being queer a crime. Team LGBTQ surpassed the 10th place of medal winners set at the Tokyo Games in 2020. They include 15 gold medals, 13 silver, and 14 bronze. Outsports counted a record number of at least 193 openly queer competitors in Paris. By most accounts, the USA women's basketball team may have been the most openly queer team at this year's Olympics. More than half the players and coaches are publicly out. The team grabbed the gold with a pulse-pounding 67-66 victory over their Olympic hosts, France. Brittany Griner led the team with her debilitating incarceration in Russia behind her. She could be seen tearing up during the playing of the U.S. national anthem. Two female Olympic boxers had their eligibility to compete as women questioned by transphobic critics. Algeria's gold medal winning cisgender female boxer Imani Khalif is punching back. Khalif is suing anti-trans writer J.K. Rowling and right-wing billionaire Elon Musk. Her criminal complaint with the Paris prosecutor's office charges that their social media posts accusing her of pretending to be a woman exacerbated acts of aggravated cyber harassment.
Record-setting British diver Tom Daley is retiring after he and Noah Williams won the silver in the men's 10-meter synchronized diving event in Paris. Daley held his customary rainbow towel on the award platform for the last time. This means that Robbie and Phoenix Black Daley will be seeing more of one father. Their power couple co-dad is the Academy Award-winning screenwriter of Milk, Dustin Lance Black. Daley was 14 years old in 2008 when he competed for the first time in Beijing. He won 3 bronze medals at the Games in London and Rio de Janeiro, and gold in Tokyo. Daley bid an emotional farewell in a brief impromptu encounter with reporters.
It's really hard to talk about. But it's, you know, I have to hang it up for some time, so.
Yeah.
I'm very proud. Right now, like, obviously, it's just a lot. But I'm really happy with how everything's gone. I just think it's always hard when you say goodbye to your sport. So I just, yeah. Lots of things to process, but you know, I think it's the right time. Like, this year felt like such a bonus, and I got to compete in front of my family, my kids, so, and I got to be flag bearer, so yeah, like, bucket list ticked off on every occasion. Wasn't expecting all of this, it's quite overwhelming, but it's so special. I just, yeah. It's hard to talk because, it's my last time, so I'm sorry.
Retiring British Olympics diver Tom Daley.
In her third try, Kim Koko Iwamoto will be the first out transgender candidate to win election to state office in Hawaii. The civil rights attorney, school board member, and queer activist defeated fellow Democrat Scott Sikey in the party's August 11th primary election. She has no Republican opposition, so her victory in November is a lock. She'll represent Honolulu and Kaka'ako. Iwamoto upset the Democratic establishment with her victory over Sikey, the entrenched incumbent who's been Speaker of the House since 2017. It was her second political coup. In 2006, she became the highest-ranking out trans person elected to a government position in the United States as the island of Oahu's representative on the Hawaii State Board of Education. She says she ran this time in part because she felt a lack of transparency in state politics. Sikey had opposed a raise in the state minimum wage, and Iwamoto believed the party was ignoring everyday Hawaiians.
Finally, Congratulations are due to Chilean flamingos Curtis and Arthur on the birth of their new chick this week. The male couple at Southwest England's Peyton Zoo in Devon apparently adopted an abandoned egg. According to the zoo's birds curator, Pete Smallbones, Chilean flamingo eggs usually take about a month to hatch. Both parents incubate and care for it on mud pile nests. Smallbones says this is the Peyton Zoo's first successful hatching of the species since 2018. Chilean flamingos live in shallow lakes across South America. The species is in decline due to habitat degradation from industrial mining operations, tourist disturbances, and egg harvesting.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending August 17th, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazor, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Marcos Najera. Stay healthy.
And I'm Sarah Montague. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
The recipe was innocently included without my realizing that the hashish was the accented part of the recipe.
The cultural landmark is baked into the recipe later in the program. Major League Baseball acted quickly when one of its stars hurled a homophobic slur at a heckling fan. The August 11th game had started on a much different note when the MLB Players Alumni Association named Boston Red Sox outfielder Jaron Duran the team's 2024 Heart and Hustles Award winner. It's supposed to recognize active players who demonstrate a passion for the game of baseball and best embody the values, spirit, and traditions of the game. Things had gone downhill by the bottom of the sixth. A talkative man in the stands yelled at Duran that he needed a tennis racket to hit a ball. Duran yelled back, "Shut up, you f***ing f***gut." Duran described the incident during a press conference.
It was just a heckler heckling me, you know, the entire game, and I just let the moment get the best of me. Just said something that I shouldn't be saying. There was no intent behind the word that was used. It was just the heat of the moment and just happened to be said. You know, it's on me for that word coming out, but there was no intent behind that word being used. I actually apologized to the umpire and the catcher for my actions because they were right there. They heard me say it, but I'm assuming they cut the mic because of my inappropriate word, so it wasn't picked up, but I know that I was apologizing to them for the word I had said.
However, a live outfield mic did catch the whole exchange, and Duran was suspended for 2 games. His prorated salary is being donated to the LGBTQ organization PFLAG. The All-Star player responded to the disciplinary action.
That's not the most important thing right now. It's just trying to be better and learn from my mistake of what I said is the most important thing right now. I've talked to a few people that have been in situations before, and I've gotten a lot of helpful information that I'm going to take to heart and take my best leap forward and go with what's best to benefit from my mistakes. I've had some fans reach out to me and tell me that they're disappointed in me, and I just wanted to let them know that I'm sorry for my actions and that I'm going to work on being better for them.
Jaron Duran's contrition and the fact that he has the support to do better are due in large part to the legacy of the late Billy Beane. Bean's standout career was recounted by Ann Northrup and Andy Hum of Gay USA TV on the occasion of his death earlier this month.
He was a Major League Baseball player for the Detroit Tigers, the LA Dodgers, the San Diego Padres for about 6 years or so. He came out after he retired, and in fact, he did not go to his lover's funeral. He played a game instead because he was so scared of being outed.
But he came out in 1999, 3 years after he left his playing days, and he was, at his death, the only out current or former player who was gay. I mean, before that, you had Glenn Burke, who died in 1995 and came out in 1982.
Shamefully treated.
So he joins the office of the commissioner, Bud Selig, in 2014. He became baseball's first ever ambassador for inclusion, focusing on player education, LGBTQ inclusion, and social justice. Promoted to vice president in 2017, adding anti-bullying efforts to his plate, and then became the senior vice president of DEI.
Teams and hold talks in locker rooms, as we would do in schools.
He is survived by his husband, Greg Baker.
Shortly after he was appointed Major League Baseball's Gay Ambassador for Inclusion in 2014, Billy Bean fielded a few questions from This Way Out's Chris Ann Eastwood and Wenzel Jones.
Baseball's a theatrical game filled with lots of traditions. Is this the first ambassador position that there has been in Major League Baseball?
Major League Baseball has two other ambassadors, and one is Roberto Clemente's wife, Vera, who is the ambassador of goodwill.
Okay.
And she's been connected to the game for over 35 years, and that the Roberto Clemente Award is a very, very prestigious
I think the top award. I think above all, I think that's the one of the most
amazing. And that's given to the player who does the most community service within their where they play, and it's really amazing because the amount of money generated in situations like that and how it goes to help, you know, underprivileged youth or whatever the charity designated by that player, it's an amazing thing. And then Tony La Russa is also an ambassador. He just got elected to the Hall of Fame, and Tony La Russa has been in baseball for over 45 years. And so I was completely humbled by the title.
You're in very esteemed company in the world of baseball. For all our listeners who are fans, I mean, this is big, big, big deal.
Could I ask a question here, though? Because I was just wondering, when you're the very first ambassador of it, do you just make it up as you go along, or did it come with a rule
book? That's a great question, because part of this process is we're defining the position as we go, and the process that got me into this. Accepting the job, we dialogued what goals they had, and I tried to explain to them all the things I've learned from the LGBT, especially the sports community, about inclusive dialogue, language, resources made available to all stakeholders, not just the players. I mean, baseball is a massive business. There's 30 teams. There's 7 minor league teams under every major league organization. You have general managers, managers, assistant managers, secretaries, you know, cleaning crews, snack bar people, construction company, you know, it's endless. And so anyone connected to the MLB family is going to be part of this process. So my job is to try to make it palatable right away that we can have some resources made available as soon as possible. And part of that is the workplace code of conduct that now includes sexual orientation for all anti-discrimination.
But this is not just LGBT stuff.
No.
I mean, from what I have read, you have a very huge scope of responsibility here as in this. You're race, gender,
religion,
disability.
And part of the inclusive message is we want the best product for baseball. Baseball's being selfish. We want the best players in the world, and if those players happen to be African American, from Asia, gay, or from Germany, whatever, we want to make it possible for them to succeed and feel welcome. And we want the players that are playing around that person to know that MLB's philosophy is that we are all in this together. It's not about finding out who is gay or it's really about making the environment, making everyone understand that inclusion and acceptance is the name of the game. So if we start to see an increase in applications for jobs within baseball from LGBT community people, people that are out, people that have worked in the corporate world and who have said, you know what, I love sports and I want to go work in sports. And now, I, from what I hear, I'm welcome here. You know, it's just something, to me, once we, from the outside in, then we're going to see multiple players start feeling comfortable, and they're going to make that huge decision on their own. But they're going to know if they need a resource, if they need a friend, someone's confidence that it's there for them.
Well, and I think we cannot overstress the importance of having an example, because I read that you grew up in the military, and I did too, and there are no examples at all. You do grow up feeling like you're the only one in the world for the longest time.
Well, my stepfather is a Marine Corps veteran, and I'm the oldest of five boys, so it was... That's what I think was where I had trouble understanding my own journey until I was in my late 20s. I had never met anybody. I was never around it. So it was is that thing, that inner dialogue that so many of us have in our community. There's a shared bond. I love when we get to sit down and share our stories, because we have so much in common, where it's really just trying to find where you fit in. And the thing about being involved in sports, and that, you know, I was so fortunate to be a professional athlete for a long time. I never thought for a minute I wanted to be out of that world.
Right.
But the job, it's not really an accomplishment. It's an opportunity. And that's the way I'm looking at it. And I have a huge responsibility in front of me. And I'm going to do my very best to build that bridge between the two worlds that should have been built a long time ago. There's so many great athletes who have not been able to completely be centered in the moment. And that's where all of us know, great performers, great singers, great actors, they got to be centered.
Major League Baseball's gay ambassador for inclusion, Billy Bean, died on August 6th of acute myeloid leukemia at the age of 60. He was interviewed in 2014 by Chris Ann Eastwood and Wenzel Jones.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
I love you, Alice B. Douglas, and so does Gertrude Stein. I love you, Alice B. Douglas. I'm gonna change your name to mine.
Literary mavens Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Douglas helped shape the avant-garde arts environment of the 20th century. Douglas was also known for her mastery of French cooking. 1954's The Alice B. Douglas Cookbook is one of the couple's best-known and most notorious books. In this rare Pacifica Radio selection from a Verve record, Ms. Douglas herself reads the infamous recipe and tells the story behind its publication.
The recipe for hashish fudge was given me by Brian Geisen, which anyone could wish up on a rainy day. This is the food of paradise. It might provide an entertaining refreshment for a ladies' bridge club or a chapter meeting of the DAA. Take 1 teaspoon black peppercorn, 1 whole nutmeg, 4 average sticks of cinnamon, 1 teapot coriander. These should all be pulverized in a mortar. About a handful each of stoned dates, dried figs, shelled almonds, and peanuts. Chop these and mix them together. A bunch of cannabis sativa can be pulverized. This, along with the spices, should be dusted over the mixed fruit and nuts, kneaded together. About a cup of sugar dissolved in a big pat of butter, rolled into a cake and cut into pieces or made into balls about the size of a walnut. It should be eaten with care. 2 pieces are quite sufficient. Obtaining the cannabis may present certain difficulties. but the variety known as Cannabis sativa grows as a common weed, often unrecognized, everywhere in Europe, Asia, and parts of Africa, besides being cultivated as a crop in the manufacture of rope. In the Americas, while often discouraged, its cousin called Cannabis indica has been observed even in city window boxes. It should be picked and dried as soon as it has gone to seed while the plant is still green. The recipe was innocently included without my realizing that the hashish was the accented part of the recipe, and that I was shocked to find that America wouldn't accept it because it was too dangerous. Well, this was an offense to the American eye and the American thought, because they were afraid they were up against the law. And so my publisher wired to Washington and asked the administration if it were possible to use such a recipe. When it appeared, there'd been an outcry. The magazines took it up. And he got as an answer from Washington, "You may do anything you please except eat it. That is forbidden by law. You may grow it, you may manufacture it, but you may not sell it, and you may not eat it." Brian Geisen himself wired me and said, "What are we doing about this?" And I said, "I'm doing nothing. What can you do?" I was shocked to find that it was hashish. I thought it was just a joke of his. And he said, "Well, something should be done." And so he wired to the editor, who paid no attention to him. He said it was too late, later in conversation. So that was that. It never went into the American edition. The English are braver. We're not courageous about that sort of thing.
That was the voice of Alice B. Toklas. The Verve record was broadcast on Pacifica Radio in 1963. Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Marcos Najera and Sarah Montague, and produced by Brian DeShazer, with technical assistance by Danielle Wisius. Our archival correspondents were Chris Ann Eastwood and Wenzel Jones. Thanks also to Gay USA TV's Ann Northrup and Andy Hum, and to the Pacifica Radio Archives. You heard music by the Rolling Stones, Nancy B, Heather Woodhead, and from the Field of Dreams soundtrack. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks John Dyer V of Winston, Oregon, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WRFZ Rochester, New York, 3CR Fitzroy, Victoria, KOOP Austin, Texas, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints. On this week's show, well, we'll have 2.5 stories for you today. First up, Mount Allison University astronomer sounds the alarm on the dangers of satellite proliferation. And she's not alone. Dr. Catherine Lovkin says Starlink has put some 7,000 satellites into orbit, and it wants 40,000 more.
Starlink is not the only company looking at doing this. According to one database I found, there are 19 separate constellations that are proposed, which would bring, if they're all approved and they all go through and do what they're planning, would put the number of satellites in orbit over 500,000.
BC's Olympian Ethan Katzberg celebrates winning gold at the Paris Olympics as he prepares for the next hammer throw competitions in Slovakia. BC's Cameron Rogers did the same in the women's competition.
It's just such an experience to take in, you know, with people congratulating me and like doing interviews and talking. You know, it's been a whirlwind, but it's been incredibly enjoyable.
And CCTV cameras have made their way into downtown Peterborough and in many other Ontario towns and cities across the country as well. Peterborough's chief of police says cameras have been a success.
One thing that we don't often hear about is it helped us exonerate somebody who had been accused of a crime. And in fact, the video showed that they did not do what they had been accused of. And that, too, is a use for those cameras.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Nice to have you with us again this week. Boris Chassin with you for the next half hour. Mount Allison astronomer Catherine Lovkin recently wrote to the U.S. Federal Communications Commission to add her voice to those concerned for the future of astronomy as unregulated satellite networks continue to grow exponentially in near-Earth orbit and wreak havoc with the ability of scientists to observe the night sky. Although they provide internet connections and soon direct cell service in rural and remote places, the reflected light from the growing number of satellites interferes with observations, and the communications coverage puts an end to radio quiet zones, making radio astronomy nearly impossible. Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick.
In the absence of broadband internet in many rural areas, it's not uncommon for households to get their internet signal from farther afield, about 500 kilometers straight up word to be exact, from a satellite circling the planet in what's called near-Earth orbit. There are currently thousands of satellites owned and operated by Elon Musk's company Starlink in near-Earth orbit, and many other companies poised to start launching bigger and better satellites that would even provide cell service directly via satellite. The world is poised for a machine population explosion in near-Earth orbit, and while it has some people excited for truly global communications access, it has astronomers worried about the future of their science. Mount Allison's Catherine Lovkin is one of them. Lovkin recently wrote to the U.S. Federal Communications Commission to add her voice to those concerned for the future of astronomy as private satellite networks continue to proliferate unregulated and wreak havoc with the ability of scientists to observe the night sky. The astronomer says that according to the European Space Agency, there have been 18,400 satellites put into orbit since the first one in 1957, and that number is about to explode. Of the original number, about 12,000 are still up there, and almost 7,000 belong to satellite internet provider Starlink.
And the problem is not necessarily having satellite internet. It's the lack of regulation. So 7,000 Starlink satellites right now. The proposal is to have something like 40,000 to 50,000 total eventually. And Starlink is not the only company looking at doing this. According to one database I found, there are 19 separate constellations that are proposed, which would bring, if they're all approved and they all go through and do what they're planning, would put the number of satellites in orbit over 500,000.
Right. How big are these satellites?
So the Starlink ones in particular are... they're pretty big, actually. According to the Starlink website itself, they are 2.8 meters by 1.4 meters for the satellite body itself. So that's, you know, car-sized-ish. But then once they're up there, they extend a solar panel to provide power, and that adds another 8 meters.
What about the size of this new Blue Walker satellite? Tell us about that.
So the Blue Walker 3 has an area of 64 square meters, which is about a third the size of a tennis court. So it's pretty big, which means it's got that much more area to reflect light. They have one or two test satellites in orbit at the moment. And right now, those are the brightest objects in the sky when they are sunlit at night.
And those are also in near-Earth orbit. They're not far, far out.
They're again, in a relatively near-Earth orbit. Near-Earth orbit is easy to get to because you don't have to go quite as high. So a lot of things go in near-Earth orbit.
Okay, let's talk about the impact. I know I like looking at the sky at night. I see satellites all the time now. What effects will the average person notice? What will it look like in the night sky?
We're at about the worst place. The effects are supposed to peak at around 50 degrees latitude north and south of the equator. So we're in that region where you're most likely to see satellites. They're going to be predominantly at dusk or dawn when the sun is still sort of just below the horizon, because you see the reflected sunlight off of them. So closer to dawn and dusk, the more likely you are to see that reflection and see the satellite itself. But you see them moving across the sky. Like you said, you know, almost every night now you go out and there's multiple satellites, and it's a big change. Back in 2016, there were about 1,000 active satellites, and I can remember being at a party with a bunch of astronomers, and somebody got a notice on their phone that they had an app or something that there was going to be an iridium flare, which was we would be able to see one of the iridium satellites pass overhead, and we all trooped outside because seeing a satellite pass overhead was kind of cool. It was a rare occurrence.
In 2017.
And then in 2019, Starlink started launching. And now when I go out stargazing with student groups or public events, I can stand there and I can watch. There's a satellite. There's a satellite. There's a satellite. And I'll see four or five in the space of 10 minutes.
Yeah. Will we get a night sky that looks just sort of like a traffic jam situation with just lights going, just sort of man-made objects in the sky instead of the stars?
We could. I saw one estimate that in the not-too-distant future, 1 in 15 points of light in the sky could be a satellite rather than a star if you go out to a dark spot. You see this one point, but there's also a lot of reflected, scattered light that's not coming from a particular point. And there's some estimates that having these satellite constellations out there reflecting light back to Earth is going to make the night sky 2 to 3 times brighter than it already is. And that's not something that you can get away from. Like right now, if you want to go stargazing and you live in a town, or like even in Sackville, the skies are not that dark. But, you know, you can go out to your camp or your cabin. You can go to Fundy or Kushbushuak. And those are dark sky preserves. And so you can get really good views of the night sky. But if we have these satellite constellations producing all this light pollution, you can't get away from that.
For the average person with the naked eye, that's one thing. Now, for astronomers, it's even worse, the problem.
It's a disaster.
Right.
The ground-based telescopes are most often either radio telescopes or optical telescopes, because those are the wavelengths that can get through the atmosphere most easily. And both of those encounter problems from the Starlink satellites that are up there now, and the problem is only going to get worse. With the optical images, we see streaks as the satellites move across our field of view, and that makes it very hard to detect objects. If you're looking for near-Earth asteroids, you want warning that some object is going to hit us. That's the kind of project that is really impacted by these satellites, because you almost can't do that kind of observation where you're looking for faint objects moving through your field of view. Transient phenomenon are another problem. We're often in astronomy looking for things that happen very quickly. And so if you have a couple of frames of data that are lost because of a satellite passing through, you may miss the event entirely. And then in radio, we have the communications blocking certain wave bands. I was looking at images this morning that showed two adjoining bands, and in one, it's a beautiful, clear image of this object, and there's no noise whatsoever. And then in the neighboring band, it's the same wavelength as the Starlink communication, and you can't see anything. It's just all noise.
We can't see, you know, how these communications devices affect each other, but like this is, yes, the unseen consequences here.
Yeah, yeah. And right now for ground-based astronomy in the radio, the telescopes are often built in designated quiet zones where, you know, you're not allowed to have a cell phone, you're not allowed to have a microwave. So to try and really limit the radio pollution. But if it's coming from space, from the orbit or near Earth orbit, you can't do that.
Now, I have heard some people say, well, we mean we have space telescopes now, like that we don't really need to worry about ground-based. But there's a lot of ground-based telescopes and a lot of astronomy happens.
A lot of astronomy happens from the ground. And this isn't a problem that is not affecting space telescopes. Even Hubble, the Hubble Space Telescope, often sees satellites passing through its field of view because it's at a slightly lower orbit than some of these constellations. There's a lot that you can only do from the ground or that you can do better from the ground. You know, there's, you know, 50-odd telescope sites around the world where we have major observatories. And that's an observatory where there might be three or four different telescopes. We can't afford to put that many objects out at L1, where James Webb is. And James Webb is oversubscribed by an enormous factor. It's, you know, four or five times at least as much people are applying for time as there is time to give. Mm-hmm. And so if we only have these very expensive elite space observatories, we're not going to be able to do a lot of astronomy.
I mean, I know you've written this letter. I'm sure other astronomers have also written to the FCC about this. It really sounds like an international problem. But I mean, you're talking to the U.S. government here about this. And what are you hoping they'll do?
I'm hoping that they'll come up with some way of regulating satellites and say, you know, it seems like space seems really big. It is really big, but near Earth orbit is a really small space. And so we need to have some way of controlling what goes on there. And it's not just the FCC. We can do the same thing here in Canada. We can advocate for regulation of satellites. The other thing that listeners can do if they feel passionate about this issue, as well as advocating for regulation, you can push governments to expand rural broadband networks so that people don't have to go with satellite internet. If there's no money to be made, they won't put the satellites up there.
Right. So we can do our, you know, the old-fashioned terrestrial style broadband internet. We don't like, and so avoid the problem of going to satellites.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if we do want to do satellites, I was reading there's ways around it. If you think about the GPS satellites are in what we call a geosynchronous orbit, so they're stationary over a single point on the Earth. You can get GPS coverage pretty much anywhere, and there's, you know, 40 or 50 GPS satellites. So if we really do think satellite internet is the way to go, then maybe what we should look at is having larger telescopes or larger satellites, more powerful satellites, higher up. If we put them at 6,000 kilometers, we would need maybe a 10,000th the number of satellites that we have, that we need now in low Earth orbit. They would be in a more stable orbit, so we wouldn't have potential pollution problems with them coming back. That's something I didn't talk about. The Starlink satellites are predicted to have a lifespan of 5 years, which means every 5 years they need to replace them. That means that they're constantly launching new ones, and they are expected to what we call deorbit the satellites every at the rate of about 25 a day once the full constellation is up. It's a hard problem, and you know, this is something that we need to figure out. And I know people in rural areas need internet, and having great cell phone coverage is also really important for a lot of people. But we need to find a way to balance those needs with our culture, our heritage. The dark sky is recognized by UNESCO as part of our world heritage, and we need to keep that.
If people are interested in this, what do you recommend that the layperson does?
Talk to your local representatives, and as like I said, advocate for satellite regulation, advocate for broadband expansion. If you can possibly avoid it, don't use Starlink. those are the big things. And just keep yourself informed of the issue.
That's Catherine Lovkin, astronomer and professor at Mount Allison University in Sackville. Lovkin has written to the U.S. Federal Communications Commission expressing concern over the impact of near-Earth satellites on the night sky and the ability of astronomers to study it. To see a visualization of the satellites surrounding the planet in near-Earth orbit, check out satellitemap.space.
That was Erica Butler.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints. Follow us on X at Frequency News. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
So it's been a couple of weeks since Nanaimo's Ethan Katzberg made history as the first ever Canadian to win gold in the hammer throw at the 2024 Paris Olympics, and he is still celebrating his big win. Another Canadian from BC, Cameron Rogers, also won her first Olympic gold medal in the women's hammer throw. Despite Katzberg's busy post-Olympic schedule, Lauren McKenzie of Nanaimo, British Columbia, found a way to reach Katzberg. He spoke with Lauren while he's training in Slovakia ahead of his next two competitions. Katzberg says he's humbled to know that his performance is inspiring other people.
You know, if my passion can inspire anybody to try hammer throw or to try track and field or sport or whatever it is, that's an amazing thing, and I'm really, it's what's happening, and that people want to, you know, see what the hammer throw is about, see what track and field is about, and it's really exciting. Myself as well as Cameron Rogers, who won the gold in the women's hammer, are both, you know, from British Columbia. So I think there's been a good amount of attention around it, and hopefully we can, you know, keep building the sport and keep promoting it as best we can.
Katzberg says the Olympics were an unbelievable event, and the last couple of weeks have been unreal for him.
It's just such an experience to take in, you know, with people congratulating me and like doing interviews and talking, and, you know, I was the flag bearer at the closing ceremonies. So being able to do that, it's been a whirlwind, but it's been incredibly enjoyable, just to kind of see the community, coming around a hammer throw. I'm doing what I love and what I'm passionate about, and, you know, being able to represent Nanaimo, I'm incredibly happy to do so. And it's been an incredible couple of weeks, and, you know, all the support online, and obviously, you know, the mayor of Nanaimo, he's saying stuff like it's really special, that the community coming out of this and just kind of supporting me and cheering me on. It was really special, and it's been a great experience.
The city of Nanaimo has posted on social media saying they're working with the Nanaimo Track and Field Club and Nanaimo Ladysmith School District to plan a celebration for Katzberg once he returns to Nanaimo. But for now, Katzberg is training in Slovakia as he has two more competitions before the season wraps up. But he says he's very much looking forward to a vacation.
So after those two competitions, I'll take a much needed rest, get the energy back in the system. Yeah, and just kind of enjoy the experience, and then get back on the horse and focus on next season.
Katzberg will be competing in the Silesia Diamond League in Poland at the end of August, and then competing in Croatia at the beginning of September before heading back home to Canada. This is Laura McKenzie.
Tune into frequencynews.ca to hear Lauren's complete interview and many others produced by our journalists from across the country.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
In July of 2023, Peterborough Police Services installed 12 closed-circuit television cameras in Peterborough's downtown core. The program is intended to, quote, promote public safety in the downtown core of the city of Peterborough, end quote, according to their website. Chief of Police Betts shared that as of July 2024, the cameras have been accessed 48 times, each time assisting in identifying suspects of violent crime, including two homicides. Journalist Edward Sweeney met up with PPS Chief of Police Stuart Betts to talk about the program and how successful the first year of the program has been.
Last summer, Peterborough Police Services installed and began a CCTV program, which stands for Closed Circuit Television and is commonly referred to as video surveillance, joining the list of Ontario communities with downtown CCTV programs, which can already be seen in Toronto, Cobourg, Belleville, Sudbury, Ottawa, London, Windsor, Niagara Falls, Kingston, and Cornwall. But to learn more about the program and to get an update on how the first year of downtown CCTV cameras has gone, Trent Radio met with Peterborough's Chief of Police, Stuart Robert Betts.
As you know, in July of 2023, we installed 12 CCTV cameras in our downtown core. We identify the areas that, quite frankly, they'd have the best possible vantage based on what we saw happening in our downtown core. So they're in 4K, highly visible, monitored only by the recordings, but not humans. Right? So humans are not watching these cameras. And that's what we talk about with passive recording and passive monitoring, if you will. It's like your home security camera at home. Nobody sits there and watches it 24 hours a day. And quite frankly, here at the police, we don't watch the cameras. We don't have the people. We don't have the inclination. But what we do use it for is an investigative aid. So when something does happen in the downtown, within the parameters of where those cameras are, we will search those cameras if it's likely that it's going to return evidence to help us to solve a crime. And quite frankly, within weeks of installing those cameras, they helped us solve two homicides that happened in our downtown area. And of course, it's helped us solve a number of crimes since then. Now, there's one thing that we don't often hear about is it helped us exonerate somebody who had been accused of a crime. And in fact, the videos showed that they did not do what they had been accused of. And that too is a use for those cameras.
And Betts came to the interview prepared with statistics of how these cameras have actually been used since their installation last year.
In the last half or last 5 months of last year, we accessed them about 24 times to look for, as I said, things like homicide, right? Yes. What can we see? This year, in the first 7 months of the year, we'd accessed it 24 times. It stands to reason we'll be over 30 times, maybe 35 times by the end of the year. And, you know, we really limit how and when we use these cameras. It's not a free-for-all. Not everybody in the organization has access to view the cameras when they choose to do so. We actually have a process in which only the supervisors, and in this case the staff sergeants, they can access those cameras on an emergent needed basis. They have to put in a request, we track it, and we monitor who's using them, why it's being used, and then of course whether it was successful or not. So typically we would use them for mostly violent type crimes, quite honestly, but we have used it for a variety of property crimes, and we've actually used it for some motor vehicle collisions as well, where it returned some evidence for us to help us with our investigation that way.
But besides the individual instances of accessing these cameras, we also spoke about the program as a whole. On the Peterborough Police Service's website, their page on the CCTV program says that the intent of the program is, quote, to promote public safety in the downtown core of the city of Peterborough, end quote. And Betts speaks to how programs like this can help do just that.
If somebody sees that you have video camera in your home, chances are they may be less inclined to break into your home or commit a crime on your property. We are trying to apply the same approach here within our downtown core. And that's why there's signage up there, not only to let people know from a privacy perspective, but also to hopefully deter people from engaging in some sort of behavior that might be caught on camera. Those cameras, they see in color, they work at night, they're in 4K, and they do a great job of what they do capture.
And so I asked Betts if there was any statistical proof he could provide that the CCTV program has acted as a successful deterrent to crime in Peterborough's downtown core. And although he did not have any evidence for it, he talks about why it is still a worthwhile program.
I'm not aware of any program that where you could conclusively say, this is the cause for that. But I can say it has helped solve crimes, and I'm happy about that.
Back before this program started, it went before City Council for approval in June of 2023, and was not unanimously supported by councillors. Trent Radio contacted Councillor Alex Burke, who is one of the people who initially opposed this program. He speaks about why he opposed it and how his perspective has changed in the first year of this program's operation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that by just talking to people and knowing people that are very much vulnerable in our community, it's my impression that programs like this continue to oppress people that are vulnerable instead of dealing like systemically with what's happening, the lack of housing, the lack of supports, the lack of jobs, et cetera, inflation, all these things. Like, I feel like focusing our energy on those things would have more of an impact locally on the issues that we're all facing. You know? Yeah,
and I understand people might have those concerns around privacy. And, you know, I think right now with the way our society is, you can't walk down a street without being on some camera somewhere. Could be a bank machine, could be the gas station. I mean, you can't fill up your car if you're and you're not on video. Every store we go into has video. This is just video in public spaces that allows us to apply a technique to help solve crimes quicker.
Truth is, I haven't thought too much about it. The ways that I've heard about it working have been positive. It kind of just is what it is at this point. And it's not something that I have a bunch of knowledge about necessarily, but like you just said, the things that have happened have seemingly been positive. From my experience on the advisory, on the committee, there's like any of the sort of fears that I talked about that I may maybe assumed about what could happen by this in an unfair way against people. Like, I think that there's really stringent policy around it that doesn't allow for any of the really harmful, maybe some intended harmful uses of it or something, monitoring people just randomly or without provocation or against their rights or anything like that. My understanding of it, it seems to be just like an extra tool for police to have, and police, we know, are stretched very, very thin, and we know that there are issues in the downtown that independent business owners are like really asking the police to respond to. And so positively, this has helped them respond.
Peterborough's CCTV program was funded through a one-time provincial grant. So there are no current plans to expand the program to further areas with more cameras.
So far, I would absolutely say it was successful. And I'll tell you, I would expand it if I could. If I could add more cameras, that would help us to sort of blanket an area that would allow community and the community members to feel safe, or feel at least if something happened, there would be some sort of evidence to help the police bring somebody to justice. I would do it in a heartbeat. And this is a low cost, relatively low cost tool to allow us to do that. And, you know, since I speak of cost, I do think it's important to say that this didn't cost the taxpayers of Peterborough anything for this equipment. We got this funding, $185,000 was a provincial grant to buy this equipment. Is there an operating cost associated to the cell service and everything else? Absolutely. But it's minimal compared to the amount of time and resources that would have to go into investigating some of these occurrences if we didn't have this video.
This has been Eddie Sweeney, reporting for the Local Journalism Initiative here in Peterborough, Ngozi-Wanang.
And that's it for us. So thanks to our journalists Lauren McKenzie, Erica Butler, and Edward Sweeney. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. Boris Chassaigne, your host and producer, thanks for having us this week. And until next, goodbye.
Or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
For 142 years, the Queen's Gaels have called Kingston home. The tricolor has become as synonymous with the city as the limestone upon which it was built. But that love, admiration, and respect comes with a powerful commitment. A pledge to protect this house. On Saturday, August 31st, the Queen's Gaels will host